Good morning. The court calls United States versus Medina. The government has certified the case, so they'll go first.
May it please the court, my name is Vasilios Tsikis. I represent the government, in this case, the United States. With the court's permission, I ask that 3 minutes be reserved for rebuttal.
So granted.
Thank you. The United States asked this court to reverse the decision of the lower court by concluding that the military judge conversation with the appellee in the plea was both factually and legally sufficient to conclude that the appellee committed the crime of sodomy under Article 125 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The United States position rests on two separate but related arguments involving the applicability and application of United States v. Harmon. First, that the colloquy requirement set forth in Harmon is not required in this case because the conduct admitted to by the appellee is categorically outside of the constitutional protection as afforded by the Supreme Court in its decision in Lawrence v. Texas. Second, irrespective of this line of reasoning, the colloquy requirement did meet the Harmon threshold requirement because the judge engaged in dialogue with the appellee that elicited answers from him that described his personal understanding of the criminality of his conduct as well as his understanding of the specific military factors that removed his conduct from constitutional protection.
What is our scope of review of this particular decision? Are we reviewing, did they do this as a matter of law, or did they say it weren't sufficient facts? They have a little different authority than our court when it comes to reviewing matters.
The standard review under Inabed, Your Honor, is that whether there is an issue of law or fact that questions the providency of the plea. Whether or not there was enough factual material on the record listed from the member, that's an issue for abuse of discretion standard. But whether or not the law itself was stated accurately or applied correctly, I would argue or state that that's de novo. Okay.
With respect to your first argument, you say Hartman is not required because the conduct is categorically outside Lawrence. What about the conduct in Hartman? Was that categorically inside or outside of Lawrence?
No, Your Honor. The factors in Hartman describe that the accused in that case had consensual sexual relationships with a member from his own unit, a naval ship, and the conduct occurred at naval barracks, a temporary house.
What's the short answer to the question, though? Yes, it was categorically outside Lawrence, or no, it was not?
No, Your Honor, it was not categorically inside Lawrence protection.
No, it was so what? Now I'm confused.
So the Hartman conduct was not categorically outside, but it was inside.
It was arguably within the limits of
Yes, arguably right.
Oh, thank you.
So are you saying that it was obviously protected or obviously not protected or neither?
It's not clear whether or not it was protected. It could implicate both.
In Hartman?
In Hartman, yes, Your Honor.
So then why do you suppose that the court found it instructive there that the facts that were not discussed with the accused were dispositive as to whether or not the behavior was or was not constitutionally protected?
But those factors could meet the mark of factors. The problem is in Hartman is that in the mind of the accused in that case, it wasn't clear whether he understood the critical distinction between what could be permissible conduct and what could be prohibited conduct. And those factors that were briefly discussed with him don't come readily apparent to a layperson why those factors matter as far as making his conduct criminal under Article 125. But that's not the situation in this case.
Because
in this case, Lawrence specifically states what is constitutionally protected. And it also has a list of those behaviors and conduct that categorically take it outside of
Well, actually, it doesn't say that, right? Actually what it says is this conduct is constitutionally protected and this conduct is not all of these other things. It doesn't say that those other things are. Just says that case is not on any of those things.
Yes. Well, I would argue that having sexual relationships with a minor or in public, those are not constitutionally protected as described in Lawrence v. Texas.
All I'm saying to you is that's not precisely what it says.
Yes, sir.
It gives a list of things that Lawrence is not.
That's right. I mean, it gives the flip coin, if you will. I mean, it's the general exceptions that it lists that in this court, in the United States v. Parkman, adopted in the second prong of Markham. So in other words, Markham, in the first prong, basically says whether or not the conduct itself is inside Lawrence's protection. And Markham, in the second prong, states whether or not the general behaviors and factors, as outlined in the court in Lawrence v. Texas, are talked about that take it outside of constitutional protection as well.
So first we decide whether it's in Lawrence, and then we decide whether it's out of Lawrence. Does that make any sense?
I think if the conduct is clearly categorically outside of constitutional protection, then there is no requirement for a heightened standard of colloquy requirement in the provency plea.
Isn't there, in any case of consensual sodomy, isn't there always a heightened requirement? Because consensual sodomy is arguably, minus the outsider, the children, or what have you, arguably constitutionally protected under Lawrence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then why isn't there always, why shouldn't a judge always impose Hartman in a case where the allegation is consensual?
Where the allegation is consensual, it may trigger, and especially in a military environment, it should trigger United States v. Hartman.
Okay, it should trigger Hartman.
Yeah, I think if there's a possibility, Your Honor, that the conduct may come into the zone of constitutional protection, then it would be appropriate for the judge to enter into a Hartman.
Why not have what legal or legal policy reason exists for not having a pretty clear standard which just says do Hartman? Hartman. If the suggestion is that it was consensual and it was adult, just do the Hartman thing.
That's right, if it was consensual, Your Honor. But if the argument is that it's one of those conducts of behavior.
What was he pleading guilty to?
He was pleading guilty to sodomy, Your Honor. That charge under 125 without the aggravating sentence elements that the President has provided are something separate. The charge is sodomy, so that charge under 125, as written, captures both consensual and forceful sodomy with minors.
It wasn't the language by force and without, wasn't that accepted?
Yes, Your Honor.
So okay, so where does that leave us?
It doesn't necessarily.
I realize 125 just prohibits sodomy and says nothing about force or lack of force. But given that the specification included that language, and given that that language was accepted out, where does that leave us?
I think it leaves us that the Constitution is clear under Lawrence that it's protecting the type of conduct that's born of intimate and personal choice, mm-hmm. that it's truly consensual, full and mutually consensual. And so if someone's pleading guilty without the sense of aggravating elements, let's just say having sex with a minor or having sex in public, there would be no necessity under the law. And the question here is whether or not the plea was provident.
Can I go back to my question, which is why not have a Hartman inquiry? Putting aside whether this particular plea is provident, why are you resisting as a general matter just having a Hartman inquiry in cases where there may be doubt, especially on something with the standard is where someone might be in a position where they cannot freely consent, right? That's the real hinge here. That seems to be pretty unclear how that might apply in military context, giving different relationships, different grade structures, previous assignments. Why not, as a matter of legal policy, just get it on the record and figure out what the correct answer is, putting aside whether this particular colloquy was adequate? Why are you resisting that as the government?
Because, Your Honor, I think there are just certain conduct that aren't protected by the Constitution. And if it's clear that the conduct is not protected by the Constitution, then the judge should not be required to...
I'll grant you that with children, with prostitution, etc., but what about this category where one's consent might not be freely given? Isn't that more obtuse? Is it really clear in Lawrence when that category is triggered?
There could be some ambiguity, maybe perhaps if you're going to a contested trial, on whether or not that captures something that's inside or outside. But when you have a counsel plea where the stipulation of facts is incorporating the very language from Lawrence, and the understanding from the counsel and the accused is that this is outside the scope of Lawrence, then there should be no trigger mechanism that makes the military judge enter in a theoretical discussion about constitutional protection, especially constitutional protection that, again, is geared toward protecting consensual sodomy between adults that's private and that is born from mutual relationships.
So you're, is that then an argument not that you don't have to do any inquiry, but that there was an inquiry and it was adequate?
Yes, Your
Honor. Which I guess moves you from argument number one to argument number two.
That's right. In that particular case, I would argue that it's no different. I mean, the Supreme Court, when it listed behaviors and factors that are outside the scope of Lawrence constitutional protection, it didn't graduate to either one of those conduct behaviors. It listed them all the same, that these are outside of constitutional protection.
No, okay. Let's go to your first point. Why is this outside the zone of Lawrence?
Well, if you're speaking, if we take the assumption that this is consensual sodomy in a military environment, then we still believe that the colloquy meant the Hartman threshold.
No, that's two. What's one? I'm asking you one.
I'm on two. He's on one.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah.
You can take them in his ordinary backwards order.
Well, you're saying the first argument, whether Hartman's even applied.
Right.
Yes. I mean, the argument, again, Your Honor, is that it's just conduct that is outside categorical.
Why?
Because the Supreme Court has said so, Your Honor. And the appellate.
Where did the Supreme Court say so?
Explain which category you think makes it categorically outside or inside.
Yes, so I don't think the Supreme Court has opined on this fact situation.
I think the Supreme Court has said that persons who are in a position where they cannot consent freely, or were consenting.
Right, which is a fairly vague reference. Now, in this case, first of all, is not consenting freely a question of fact or a question of law?
Well, it's a little bit of both, Your Honor.
It's a little mixed question. Okay. Now, in this case, the victim, let's call him that, came over to the appellant's house. There was no longer any command or supervisory relationship, that's admitted. He felt comfortable enough, with the appellant to get stinking drunk with him, mutually stinking drunk with him. He felt comfortable enough with the appellant to tell him no the first time the appellant allegedly made some move on him, and he felt comfortable enough eventually to say it was wrong. Now, where was his will overborne, or where was he not willing to object?
Your Honor, I think there are lingering vestiges of authority in this particular case.
Well, where are they? There may be lingering vestiges and emanations and penumbras, but if you feel comfortable enough with your ex-company commander to go get stinking blotto drunk with him, how does that have any lingering vestiges of anything, well, other than that you know the guy?
Yes, but I think someone getting highly intoxicated with somebody isn't an invitation for sexual activity. And then when he clearly indicated that he was repulsed by the sexual advances.
Right, he did not feel, yeah, which way does that cut? He certainly had no compunction by telling him, get your hand out of my pants.
Yes, but in this particular case, the appellee continued to pursue the former trainee.
Well, the interesting thing is that between the first incident and the second incident, the former trainee also did the rather remarkable thing of saying, by the way, can I sleep here?
Yes, and we can only speculate on why that was the case.
Well, we can only speculate on what lingering vestiges of anything was going on here.
Only by the fact, though, that on the record, the appellee had admitted that there was a coercive relationship that was manifested at boot camp, and it continued on during the incident in question. So the appellee himself has admitted to the very fact that we're kind of speculating here, saying it was a coercive relationship, and the accused was not in a position to consent freely. And so that factual determination that gets us through the Markham loopholes, you will, and also makes sure that the appellee understood the criminality of his conduct is met by his own very assertions.
Can I ask you to turn to argument two, please?
Yes, Your
Honor. And compare and contrast this plea colloquy, the whole package, with Hartman. What is the same and what is different? Presumably you'll take the view that there's something different. Please focus on what it is.
Yes. First, I would say the military judge described the crime of sodomy only by the single definition as outlined in the manual for court-martial, that it was unnatural carnal copulation. And the accused just simply described his sexual activity, that it was...
Are you in this case or in Hartman?
In Hartman, Your Honor, yes. There was discussion initially on the Markham factors, but they were between the trial counsel and the military judge. And when the military judge did direct those Markham factors at the appellee, they only listed perfunctory responses to where the question took place and with whom. So it wasn't readily apparent to any layperson why that sexual conduct was criminal. In other words, without those factors, his conduct would be permissible. This is different in that case because, number one, the military judge, in our case, not only laid out the crime of sodomy with regards to the single statutory element, but he also relayed to the appellee additional criteria that his conduct in it and of itself is not a crime, but it also had to be prejudicial to good works.
Or did he explain that conduct had constitutional consequences?
What it did for the mind of the appellee is understood that there are certain...
But aren't we looking here under Hartman as to whether he understood the relationship between the distinctions drawn in Lawrence and Markham between constitutionally protected behavior and criminal conduct? And that's what we're looking for. Where did he make that specific distinction in his colloquy with the defendant?
Well, first he laid out those elements, Your Honor, and then secondly, there was a discussion.
But the elements that you're saying he laid out in Article 134 elements aren't part of Article 125, are they?
No, Your Honor, they're not. But what they are is they're functionally equivalent to discussing the Markham factors themselves and laying out for the appellee that...
Whoa!
Why don't you respond to Judge Erdman's question?
Respond to Judge Erdman, and I've got a question.
Judge Erdman has asked you, where in the colloquy is there a relationship drawn between the facts that have been elicited and the constitutional dilemma that Lawrence and Markham present?
Yes, Your Honor. My time's up, but I'll be happy to answer the question. That there was not only that he laid out, I think Carmen specifies that there needs to be a critical distinction between what's permissible and what's prohibited conduct. But then there was a discussion with the defense, the appellee's defense counsel, that he affirmed that his client knew that there was Markham factors that needed to be considered and that he understood the Markham factors. And then the judge gave an illustrative example of his, what the judge called his constitutional concerns by giving this example of like consensual relationship going to California and getting married.
Did he ever explain why he was doing that?
To explain that there were constitutional concerns that he wanted to convey to the appellee.
Let me put it a slightly different way. Is there anywhere in the plea colloquy or otherwise where the military judge said, accused, if you did this with SN, blank, believing that he was completely consenting to it because he offered to stay at your house, et cetera, and there was no coercive relationship and he could have said no, then it's not a crime and I can't accept your plea. But if he did this because of a coercive inherent relationship and he was unable to say no, then it's not and I can't accept your plea.
I think he did that in a very succinct fashion by saying, it's not just the sodomy in this case that makes it criminal, but it has to be also prejudicial to order and discipline. And the appellee understood that and affirmed his understanding of that distinction. And then throughout the colloquy, he talked about the relationship he had. And then finally on page 77, when he did say that it was because he was a company commander in E6 that made it prejudicial to order and discipline, the judge made a follow-on question, says, is this in the context with everything we've spoken about company commander?
So do you think that prejudicial to good order and discipline is the same thing as lingering vestiges of authority that mean that you can't say no?
It depends if you're analyzing this case under the second prong of Markham or the third prong. So that example would go through the second prong of Markham that wouldn't elicit a Hartman example. But prejudice, good or discipline goes to the third prong of Markham, Your Honor.
What does our case law say about whether it is the appellant, the defense counsel, or the judge that has the obligation to understand the law and relate it to the facts? In this case, unlike Hartman, there's this discussion between the defense counsel and the judge about Markham. But it's a discussion between the judge and the defense counsel. And so the question is it the accused who needs to articulate an understanding of Markham, or is it the defense counsel? And if so, why?
Your Honor, my position is that the accused needs to understand that there's a crucial distinction between what's permissible and what's criminal under the Uniform Code of Military Justice when it relates to consensual sodomy. So I don't think he needs to articulate Markham, you know, and it doesn't require a form book analysis. I think what's required is that it's laid out some realm that it's permissible conduct, and in this case he said, look, sodomy alone is not a crime, but it has some additional criteria, specific prejudicial criminal discipline, which captures the third prong, the specific factors that remove this conduct from constitutional protection. And so in the mind of the appellee, he understood that right from the get-go. And then with the illustrative examples, and then with the affirmation by his own defense counsel, we understand that he understood the Markham factors. And I would make a couple points to that, Your Honor, is that first, there's a presumption that defense counsel's talk on behalf of their client. And that's what he did. And so he said that not only I understand the Markham factors, but we understand the Markham factors. And Hartman doesn't call for this kind of zone of silence, if you will, that covers over the appellee anytime he's not talking to the judge directly. He can hear and listen to what's happening. In Hartman, there was an exclusive discussion with the trial counsel. In this particular case, it was the defense counsel. And the subsequent questions after that dialogue, he affirmed what he heard. He made it on the record that he clearly articulated that everything that just had transpired between the defense counsel and military discussion, he understood by saying, hey, this is prejudicial good or discipline, and this is in the context of everything we just talked about on the record.
Okay. Now, I'll ask my question. How is importing an element that is not an element of the offense get you around the constitutional concerns that Judge Erdman was looking into?
Your Honor, what?
And how does importing an element that's not an element get you, where are we with Fosler and its progeny?
Yes,
and where are we with the elements test? And where are we?
Your Honor, when he talked about the factors of prejudicial good or indiscipline, arguably he should not classify them as elements. They were factors to be discussed. Now, whether he said, in addition to just the single statutory element under 125, I have to talk about the factors of prejudicial, that your conduct also has to be prejudicial.
No, he has to talk about under Hartman. He has to talk about this has constitutional dimensions, and do you understand that as a consequence of this plea? And I don't, it doesn't appear to me, it's not apparent to me how hauling in the terminal elements from Article 134 satisfies the constitutional concern, at least cast in the way it was cast.
To make an analogy to illustrate a point, I think this is no different than perhaps charging someone under adultery where there's consensual sexual intercourse. And of course, sexual intercourse is a fundamental right protected under the Constitution, where there was no requirement under Hartman to go into this kind of very intense discussion of constitutionally protected conduct. You just simply say you engage in sexual, consensual sexual intercourse, and that's prejudicial good or indiscipline, and that's enough. So in this particular case, Lawrence did not say it's a fundamental, nevertheless it is a constitutionally protected right. But in this case, it's no different. The judge did nothing more than was required under 134, consensual sexual intercourse, that's prejudicial good or discipline. We're only talking about sodomy in this case.
Nothing's required under 134 because 134 isn't charged.
No, I understand. I was making an example, Your Honor, that under a 134 charge, whether it's consensual sexual intercourse, arguably sexual intercourse is.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
That's
okay.
Counsel, on rebuttal, I would like you to address the following question, okay? Based on what is actually in the plea colloquy, including the military judge instructing the appellee that basically neither force nor consent neither force nor lack of consent are required. Based on everything that was told, why wouldn't the appellant have believed that the fact that he had consensual sexual relations with this SN, because he was an E6 and the other person was whatever an SN is, an E1, that alone, without more, was enough to take it outside, to make it criminal? And whether it is or isn't is a different question. But do you understand my question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Commander Paul Casey, and I represent the appellee, GM1 Wilson Medina. This court should affirm the ruling of the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals because appellee's plea to the charge of fraud was not fraudulent. The military judge failed to engage appellee in a colloquy which established appellee's acknowledgement and understanding of the differences between permissible and prohibited behavior. The fundamental requirements into any providence of any guilty plea in accordance to RCM 910 in United States v. Care requires a military judge to address personally an accused to ensure that an accused understands the criminality of his actions and the nature of the offense for which he pleaded guilty.
Do you disagree that a colloquy could have been made related to the facts of this case that could have established that?
Of course, Your Honor, a colloquy could have established.
What should that colloquy have included?
Yes, Your Honor. It would look somewhat similar to the colloquy you proposed to the government. The first part would have to be some acknowledgement from the military judge to elicit factors that place this activity outside of protection. There needs to be a discussion between the military judge and the accused acknowledging that factor, that sometimes this conduct could be permissible, and an acknowledgement of that. And most importantly, after those factors were elicited, the military judge and the accused need to have a conversation about how those factors are applied in the accused conduct to make it a crime. And that acknowledgement needs to come from the accused. It can come from no one else.
So in this case, would the military judge have needed to elicit from the appellant, for example, that this was a situation where, because of the prior relationship, consent could not easily have been refused, or something along those lines?
That would have been one fact, ma'am, that, Your Honor, that would have been needed to be elicited.
Were there any orders violations that were brought up in the colloquy or otherwise?
There were not, and that's another critical problem with the record of trial before the court this morning. For one, this was not prohibited against the Coast Guard regulations at this time. There was no mentor-mentee relationship. They were not in the same chain of command, and it was completely acceptable at the time of the conduct for an E6 and an E3 to enter into a social relationship.
In the Coast Guard?
In the Coast Guard, yes, sir.
Would the colloquy have been adequate if the statement had been from the accused, "I understand Markham," rather than "we understand Markham" from the defense counsel?
No, Your Honor, that would not be satisfactory. The military judge then would be responsible to ask further questions to establish the accused understanding. "I understand Markham" is not satisfactory. Well, you know, the military judge would then, for example, have to ask, well, you know, what does Markham, has defense counsel explained Markham in your own words, how is Markham applied to the military? And those answers from the accused must satisfy the military judge that he understands, again, that critical distinction between what is permissible and what is permissible.
If this were a case involving, I'm trying to figure out if we're on a continuum or a black and white line. If this were a case involving the series commander, the officer in charge of the boot camp, and the offense occurred during boot camp, and the victim or the person not charged said, oh, I did this voluntarily. This is something I wish to do. Does this colloquy have to occur or not?
Yes, it does, Your Honor, because this court in Hartman stated very clearly that when a charge may implicate both constitutionally protected and criminal conduct, a further inquiry is required. By its nature, Article 125 on its face may implicate both constitutionally protected and criminal behavior.
From your standpoint, it's in doubt whether a officer at boot camp and a recruit at boot camp can constitutionally engage in consensual sodomy. That is up in the air constitutionally.
It may be, Your Honor. However, it always goes back to the accused's understanding. And going back to a Providence inquiry, if the accused is pleading guilty to this, then the accused needs to, and the military judge must be satisfied that.
So what I think I hear you saying is, in all cases, or perhaps I should, I don't want to be gross, but you're saying, in your view, Hartman should occur in every case involving sodomy that may be consensual.
Correct,
as a matter of fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
You don't disagree that if it's with someone under the age of 16 or someone under the age of 12, that it need not be conducted, do you?
Correct.
And if there's force involved?
Correct.
And let's just take sodomy off the table and let's change the scenario that the Chief Judge asked you about. What if it was just a consensual sexual encounter without delineating what the sex involved between a company commander and a recruit during that time? Do you believe that a Lawrence inquiry would be required, or do you think that they would be able to go have an orders violation or some other thing, or you think that that's constitutionally protected also?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that under what Hartman stands for is, you know, any charge which may implicate constitutional protection.
Well, you don't disagree that in the military context that there could be an order written that prohibited relations of a sexual nature or otherwise between an officer and an enlisted person, and that would not require a Lawrence inquiry.
Correct, Your Honor.
And so, for example, if that sort of behavior was prohibited by an order, is that behavior prohibited in the Coast Guard between officers and enlisted people?
Yes, Your Honor.
Between trainers and trainees while they're in the training environment?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so, under an orders violation theory of criminality, those actions could be pursued?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, listening to the arguments, it seems to me that what we're talking about is the CARE inquiry that was originated back when in the 60s sometime, I guess, following Boykin v. Alabama in the Supreme Court. And the body of law that has arisen under CARE seems to suggest if something is raised to the judge that would cause the plea to be improper, he has to explore it and satisfy himself and satisfy the accused, might raise self-defense, might raise consent, might raise all kind of things. Seems to me if you raise that this was consensual sodomy, then the judge has a duty under Hartman to explore it with him and clear that up, just like all those other cases. Is this anything remarkably different just because of Lawrence v. Taylor?
No, Your Honor. This is a Hartman case.
Yes. And isn't that what the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals said, that they didn't explore this?
That's exactly correct. This is a Hartman case. This is a Providency case, Your Honor. This is really not a constitutional case.
And is that a question of fact that they decided? They looked at factually in this record, they didn't make the hurdle, or is this a matter of law? Legally, they didn't make the hurdle. I mean, I used to call them the 800-pound gorilla. I think some other judges said they aren't that strong, but they have a lot of power down there to say, we don't like this plea.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals, probably it is a little bit. The military judge didn't satisfy a proper plea as a matter of law, and he didn't elicit many factors that establish that.
Yeah, from your point of view, what is the government trying to get us to do? Are they trying to get us to rewrite Hartman, to say this is categorically outside, therefore Hartman doesn't apply? Or are they trying to say no harm, no foul in this case if you read the whole record? What do you think the government's asking us to do?
I think the government's argument categorically is asking this court to rewrite Hart and to ignore some very basic tenets that this court outlined in Hartman regarding a provident plea. And of course, that can't be the case because the government's major flaw is that not only does it ignore this court's ruling in Hartman, it really ignores the requirements, the long-held established requirements of what a provident plea would look like.
And perhaps Judge Baker was exploring whether or not it's reasonably raised under the facts.
Correct, Your Honor.
And Judge Ryan, too, perhaps.
And there's several problems with the plea as far as the factors that were elicited. And the first being, starting in the Joint Appendix at page 55, the first being is the military judge confusing the elements, adding elements of prejudicial to good order and discipline and service discrediting to the charge of sodomy. So off the bat, the military judge is essentially leading the accused astray as to what the elements are that he is pleading guilty to.
He must have read Markham.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He must have read Markham, because Markham, those factors which bring it outside is when it's prejudicial to good order and discipline.
Counsel, right? let me ask you another question along the lines of, like, what could or could not be done. Do you think that if in this case, instead of charging the charge that they did under Article 125, they had charged him with, in that, you know, this person did have a consensual sexual relationship with someone that was in a, you know, lower pay grade, which conduct was prejudicial to good order and discipline, all right, full stop, period. And then during the plea colloquy, the military judge asked the appellee, and why was your conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline? And he responded, because, you know, if people knew that, you know, an E6 and an E1 were carrying on and having social things, and they would have less respect for me, and good order and discipline would go out down by the wayside. Problem or no problem?
And the act is a sodomy.
I don't care if it's sodomy or it's whatever. So it's some consensual sexual activity between an E6 and an E1. And it specifically charges, they did this thing, and under Article 134, it's prejudicial to good order and discipline. And during the plea colloquy, the military judge elicits from them facts showing why it has a direct and culpable effect on good order and discipline. Problem?
I still think there's a problem, Your Honor. And the problem is that as long as the military judge establishes that, first, that with the accused, that in the outside or in the civilian world, this would be protected conduct. However, in the military, there are certain...
There's all sorts of stuff that under Article 134 would be protected, but it's not protected because it falls, when it falls properly under Article 134.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going back to the language in this court's opinion in Hartman, which states, when a charge may implicate constitutionally protected conduct, I read that to include any charge that may implicate a constitutional right, either in the civilian world or the military world.
Okay, but you don't disagree with that in theory that could be a criminal, that could be a proper criminal charge, do you?
As long as it is established on the record, Your Honor, of course, that can be a criminal charge.
What is the judge supposed to do here? Now, you know, admittedly, the judge here kind of performed amateur surgery on the offense by importing the elements of 134, and the government argues that, well, he didn't really import the elements, he just used them as an illustrative example. What is the judge supposed to do here that he didn't do?
Yes, Your Honor.
On argument two of the government.
Yes, Your Honor. What the military judge failed to do here at the outset was get the elements right. So that's the first thing.
Well, did he advise the accused that was an element of the offense?
He did not.
I understood he advised the accused of the elements of Article 125.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then he brought in the terminal elements for some reason. But what should he have done?
He should first acknowledge with an accused that consensual sodomy may be protected conduct, and only after certain factors are met can it be criminal in the military, as discussed in the United States v. Marshall. After which, the military judge should ask an accused those questions. And that's what happened, or that was the start of Hartman, the Hartman inquiry in the actual case of Hartman. After the bare bones elements dialogue, the trial counsel prompted the military judge to ask questions regarding the presence of third parties in the room, the military relationship of the actors, and the location of the sodomy. That's probably step two. However, what was lacking in Hartman and what's lacking here in this case was the follow-on questions which need to come, which would look somewhat like, the reason, this falls outside of Markham, this is conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline. You have a relationship that is prohibited by the Coast Guard regulations. Is it yes or no? That is outside. Now, do you accuse or understand of the questions I just asked you in the distinction between why this is criminal in the military vice, maybe not criminal in the civilian world? And that answer, again, needs to come directly from the accused. Just like, to go back to the record of trial in this case, Your Honor, after the military judge asked his questions, the defense counsel stood up and said, I understand the Markham inquiry, and he doesn't mention Lawrence by name, I believe, in the record. He says, we understand that, we're trying to get around the Supreme Court case, to which he had a colloquy between the military judge and the defense counsel. All the while, the accused, the appellee here in this case, was a mere bystander. He was a mere bystander, and that's another hard, fast rule from Hart.
Okay, so now you're addressing Judge Baker's question, which is who has to do what? What can be elicited from defense counsel? What has to be elicited from the accused? Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. In the government attempts to distinguish Hartman in this case, but in fact they are factually equivalent. The problem that is that was in Hartman, and the problem that is here before the court this morning, is that the accused was a mere bystander. There's a lot of questions going on. There's a lot of discussions between the attorneys in the room about Supreme Court precedent and constitutional law. But the accused, the appellee here, Giamuan Medina, is a mere bystander.
How do you answer the government's contention that, well, he stipulated that the victim was a person whose will could be overborne, and that's enough?
I would answer that in a couple ways, Your Honor. First, the record doesn't support that. The record is riddled with holes that suggest that appellee or CMJM was not a person easily coerced. He was a 23-year-old man. He's not a typical recent boot camp graduate. He's got some world experience. The fact that he was permitted by Coast Guard regulations to enter into a friendship. The record also suggests trial counsel himself, outside of the joint appendix, on page 193 of the record, in his argument says CMJM and the appellee were pursuing a friendship, and probably the most significant is, I believe, as you've asked the government, was he had no problem drinking with him, he had no problem refuting the advances in the first, and he was very comfortable staying the night. And lastly, he was also very comfortable after 1 minute of around 1 minute of the act of sodomy telling appellee that this is wrong, and appellee immediately stopped. So I contest that this was an inherently coercive relationship. And again, going back to the provenance issue, Your Honor, those should have triggered the military judge to ask further questions. It is the military judge's duty to ask those further questions to ensure the provenance of this plea. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, I'd like to offer a brief conclusion.
Please.
Like the failed inquiry in Hartman, the military judge here failed to establish Appellee's understanding of the criminality of his actions. Thus, this court cannot view Appellee's plea to the charge of sodomy as that of his property. Therefore, Appellee asks this court to reform the ruling of the Coast Guard Board of Criminal Appeals and authorize rehearing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Government, opportunity for rebuttal, please.
Your Honor, to your question, Your Honor, when speaking to consensual sodomy in a military environment, Hartman requires that the accused understand that his conduct is not per se a violation of the law. In this particular case, the appellee made it clear that he understood that his conduct was more than just the sexual conduct itself that made it a violation of the law. And this is because of the colloquy he engaged with the military judge. Again, while I know he incorporated the elements and described them in elements, in fact, they are factors. I mean, he had to discuss those in one way, shape, or form. And in fact, by describing them as elements, it only showed to the accused that the government had a higher burden to demonstrate there was beyond reasonable doubt to prove these terminal elements. And again, this is no different requirement when it comes to fundamental sexual intercourse, fundamental constitutionally protected right for sexual intercourse. There are no additional criteria to launch into a very detailed discussion of constitutional protected rights. And so I think it is within the record right from the get-go that he understood what is permissible conduct in the military environment when it comes to the sexual sodomy and what's prohibited conduct.
I guess what my question is where in the record is there anything that suggests that he believed he was guilty for any other reason that he engaged in consensual sodomy with someone that was a recent graduate?
The emphatic statement will come on page 77 when he said, I'm an E6 and his former company commander. That's why it's prejudicial to go under discipline. And the follow-on question where the judge says, and this is in context with everything we talked about, and being a former company commander, would you still have the inherent coercive ability over this member? And he said yes, which also is reflected in the stipulation of facts. And so we can't just extract certain parts of the record that we want to look at. We look at the entire record, the discussion in the whole. And in fact, there was an Article 128 assault that was done. There was a copious amount of alcohol that was involved in this case. And there was misgivings from the appellee himself saying, like, I messed up, I did the wrong thing. I shouldn't have done that. All those indicate that this was not a situation of the type of relationship born of intimate choice and personal will. And thus, going to the first argument of the government's case, this is, again, not the type of sexual relationship that Lawrence had envisioned to be protected under the Constitution. And it's clear throughout the record that the victim in this case was, in fact, in a coercive relationship. He was drunk. He couldn't go home. He was given a ride by the appellee himself to his own house. And to walk back to the gate through to the Coast Guard installation drunk could have caused him problems. So there's ample reasons we don't know why he didn't leave. And going to the victim's mindset is difficult after he's been assaulted, so to speak. I see my time is up. Can I just quickly summarize?
You may.
Just reading the record in a whole, the appellee understood both what he's being charged with and why his conduct was criminal. And for those reasons we've discussed, Your Honor, we ask that you reverse the lower decision.
Yeah. Chief Judge, I have one very quick question. Do you happen to know if the military judge's bench book has a paragraph in there about a Hartman inquiry?
Not to my knowledge, no, Your Honor. Thank you.
Would you like to address the question as well? Just in terms of...
I have the same answer as the government.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Can you say?
Yep. Okay. The case is now submitted. We thank counsel from both sides here, and we stand in recess until further order of the court.
All rise. court stands adjourned until further order of the court.